It's 10:06. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Well, an article in last week's edition of Newsweek caught everybody's eye here at the Kathleen Dunn program. The title is very provocative. Why Almost Everything You Hear About Medicine is Wrong. Well, if that doesn't sound like a talk show waiting to happen, I don't know what does. And so we have the author of that article with us to talk about what she meant by writing that almost everything we hear about medicine is wrong. My guest this hour is Sharon Begley. She's an award-winning writer and science editor at Newsweek. And that is where this article appeared. She joins me by phone. And Sharon Begley, good morning. You're snowed in New York, I guess. Oh, you know what? I have to press a button here first.
Good morning, John.
Yes, good morning.
Just over a foot of snow, and even though it's New York rather than Atlanta, they don't seem to know how to deal with it, so I'm snowbound.
Okay. Well, we're getting a little bit of snow here in Wisconsin, too, but I should be able to drive home today anyway. That aside, why do you say that almost everything you hear about medicine is wrong? I guess before I let you answer that, my assumption is that we hear so much about medicine that some of it has to be wrong, but I guess I hadn't assumed that most of it was wrong until I read your article.
Well, that's exactly right. The airwaves, the newspapers, websites are just full of news about health, how to live longer, how to avoid getting serious, chronic, deadly diseases. And so much of it is based on very small studies or a single study. In other words, something that really has very little chance of standing the test of time. Now, there's the key word in what we're talking about is almost everything. So let me just cut to the bottom here and say that some of the conclusions that biomedical research has reached are, of course, absolutely correct. Things like, you know, smoking is a good way to kill yourself. It is a great idea to keep your blood pressure within normal bounds so you don't have a stroke. Things like that. Those are, no one is saying that those need to be overturned. It's the little things here and there, like, oh, blueberries will keep your memory sharp, or antioxidants are the way to go in terms of your diet. Those are the things you have to be skeptical of.
Well, and you mentioned blood pressure. For a while, we were told, "Oh, salt is the devil, and don't watch your salt intake because that causes high blood pressure." And then along comes another study saying, "Eh, not so much. Have all the salt you want. It doesn't matter."
That's exactly right. And one of the things that the researchers told me as I started reporting this was, whenever you see something about a single ingredient, again, whether it's, oh gosh, you know, tomatoes and prostate cancer, or salt and blood pressure, or, you know, not to pick on blueberries, but yes, blueberries and memory, that again is where you have to be skeptical. So yes, although it is a excellent idea to keep your blood pressure within normal limits, whether salt is the villain in pushing them beyond that limit is definitely open to question.
Well, and each of us has different tolerances for different types of the chemicals that we commonly ingest. Some people aren't bothered by salt. Some people can smoke for 70 years and not get cancer. It seems to me that there always has to be some sort of asterisk on any of these things we consider to be axioms.
Yes, there's always individual variation, and that is key. But of course, when biomedical researchers do their studies, they're trying to come out with something that applies to most people. And, you know, even in your example about lung cancer, well, in fact, not only do many long-term smokers not get lung cancer, the rate is actually only 17% of smokers get lung cancer, but smoking also causes things like emphysema, heart disease, et cetera. So there are a lot of ways to make yourself very gravely ill and perhaps even dead from smoking. But yes, there is individual variation. But the concern is that even when we look at the broad averages, and again, that's what most of these studies are saying, that, you know, just to pick on another poor thing, you know, garlic is going to save us or to ward off heart disease or lung cancer. Another recent one, eating a big breakfast will cut the total number of calories you take in over the rest of the day and therefore might be good for dieters. Again, those were cast as being true for the average person. And it turns out that even that modest claim is open to question, that it might not even be true for most people, leaving aside individual variation.
Well, and let's face it, none of us wants to be average. We want to be above average, right?
And we all are, right?
We don't. I mean, if your aspiration is to be average, that just seems rather sad. Let's talk about medical research, because this seems to be the crux of this. We have so many different competing claims out there. Describe for me who's doing all this research, how does it take place, and what drives it?
Let me take the last one first, what drives it. A great deal of biomedical research is funded by the government in this country, the National Institutes of Health. For purely, public-spirited, let's keep the country healthy purposes. And these are studies that look, for instance, at, as I said, sort of individual food nutrients, or perhaps even larger categories, like this whole basket called fruits and vegetables, or the large thing called antioxidants. The idea being that, if we can discover something important for individuals' health, then we will have a healthier country, and you can play that out all the way toward, a lower Medicare bill. So all good things will come from learning truly and accurately what will keep us healthy. So that's one motivation. But of course, a huge motivation, because the other source of biomedical funding comes from private sources, mostly the pharmaceutical industry, to some extent the medical device industry. And there, the motivation is, of course, to sell product, to show that their new compound is an effective drug against one or another disease, to show that their new medical device will do better than the old ones or than a drug, because medical devices are often pitted against medications. And there, too, when the motivation is a profit one, definitely an asterisk is in order.
Well, and there's always the drive to be the first one to introduce a new class of drug, because if you're first in the market, then you can capture market share, and everybody else is playing catch up. How does that? The assumption I guess I would make there is that has to have an effect on how the research is done and the quality of the research. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, although I don't want to be too hard on the pharmaceutical companies for the following reason. They do have to jump through enormous hoops. The benchmark estimate is that it costs about $1 billion to develop a new compound, a new medication. They have to prove, quote-unquote, safety and efficacy. It has to pass muster with the Food and Drug Administration. So it's not easy to pull the wool over the regulators' eyes and get a new compound into the market. What we have learned over the last few years is that a number of the studies funded by the pharmaceutical companies are never published in the open biomedical literature. By law, they do have to be submitted to the FDA, but they do not have to be published. Therefore, your doctor, the hospital where you might go, they do not see the studies that perhaps were not quite so positive about a new medication. Where we saw that most clearly was in antidepressants, which of course have been the subject of a great deal of concern, both about their safety, whether they increase the risk of suicide in some people, especially adolescents and younger people, and also about whether they are any better than a placebo, better than a sugar pill. And what we have learned is that about half of the studies that showed that were funded by pharmaceutical companies and that showed that antidepressants were in fact not effective were never published. So both the public and individual physicians are not getting a full picture about these medications.
So I guess that leaves me with the question, given that the average consumer has no control over the research taking place or whether it's released, how do you then, and how even do our physicians then, make sure that the information that they're getting is good information? I mean, if I go to my doctor and he recommends that I take drug X for condition Y, how can I have any confidence now that's actually going to be true?
Well, I'll go you one better, John, because so many public health authorities, including the government, have kicked it back to us patients, to us consumers, when there is a controversy about, what shall we pick? Mammograms or hormone replacement therapy, or whether people who have never had heart disease should take statins. When there is a controversy about that, what do they always tell us? ask your doctor, right? People should consult with their own physicians. Well, you know, with managed healthcare and all the other changes in medicine, and the fact that physicians get to spend, what is it, on average like 11 minutes with you these days, they don't have time to do that. They don't have time to read all of the literature. They certainly are not doing the original research themselves. So all of this is my long-winded way of saying to you that there really is no simple answer to your question to what can you do. I mean, you can't be your own doctor. You have to rely on them. You know, probably the best thing you can do is when a physician tells you that you would be better off on this particular medication, again, if you can squeeze in an extra 30 seconds, the question would be, well, why? What is the research that leads you to tell me this? Many physicians, of course, will now respond to email. I have had some success in asking my own doctors, you know, just tell me a few of the studies that you think, you know, support what you are saying. And then, you know, again, it's unfortunate because none of us has any time to do this, but you do have to just start digging through the literature yourself. I don't mean going on crazy, you know, health-oriented websites, but going into the published literature because although, as I say, a vast amount of what we hear about medicine is wrong, you can find the cautionary studies, the studies that say, well, hold on, maybe this thing that a lot of people believe is not, in fact, accurate.
Is there, do you know of any sort of web aggregator site that would maybe collect these things so that you didn't have to comb through the New England Journal of Medicine and Lancet and all of these other publications? Is there some place that collects this information? And if not, why not?
This is a business opportunity waiting for some smart person to seize.
Oh, man, and I had to blurt it out on the air.
I should have just filed for a patent. To my knowledge, no. I mean, people can indeed go to the primary literature. PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, is the site that includes all of the biomedical research, and it has, you know, the usual search terms. You can put in statin. You can put in cardiovascular disease. But, you know, I mean, how is it the ordinary consumer, the ordinary patient, able to wade through, as you correctly said, the New England Journal papers and Lancet papers and Journal of the AMA papers? It just isn't easy. You know, what the experts I spoke to said is take things with a grain of salt. In general, the newest, coolest, you know, most heavily promoted thing on the market is the one that you should be most skeptical of. And, you know, even on things like, oh, I mean, again, just to take the media to task, the new class of cancer drugs, anti-angiogenesis drugs, which block the blood vessels that feed cancers. Again, not that people have a choice about what chemotherapy they should take. You were really in the hands of your physician in that situation. But those two turned out to be not at all able to live up to the hype that the media showered all over them. Again, when I say that the newest thing is something that you should be skeptical of, the drugs that the FDA has been recalling, whether it's putting a black box warning on antidepressants, concerns about Avandia, the recall of Vioxx, it's not a bad idea to wait a few years to see if something really has leaped the hurdles of safety and efficacy.
We're talking about how to figure out whether information you have about medicine is right or wrong. And it turns out that there's a lot of really bad information out there. And that's what we're talking about this hour. You may have questions about this. I would invite you to join the conversation at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Email works, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and there's also a Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. You can go there and leave a comment or a question as well. I have the science editor for Newsweek with me this morning, Sharon Begley, to answer your question. She wrote the article, Why Almost Everything You Hear About Medicine Is Wrong. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. 22 minutes after 10 o'clock. Coming up later on the Ideas Network, after 5, my good friend Ben Marins and his guests talk about some of the best new business books. Join the conversation with your questions and comments about helpful books on business topics you'd like to learn more about. That's coming up after 5 o'clock today on At Issue with Ben Marins. This hour, we're talking about medical research and why so much of it is, well, not to be depended upon. My guest is Sharon Begley, the award-winning writer and science editor at Newsweek. You can find her work at newsweek.com. The article that she wrote that provided the springboard for this program is titled Why Almost Everything You Hear About Medicine Is Wrong. She is on the phone with me, and you can be too. Still a line for you available at 800-642-1234. Well, Sharon Begley, before we go to the phones, and we are getting a lot of calls, as I expected on this, one thing you touched on a moment ago leads me to want to talk a little bit about the media's role in all of this, because there certainly seems to be a lot of media interest. We've got the 24-hour news cycle. We've got the World Wide Web and Twitter and Facebook and everything else, and traditional radio and television and newspapers and so forth. But it just seems like everybody is looking to make a really, really big deal about even the most minor indications that something might be a success or something might help us cure cancer or diabetes or something like that. Is there a media culture that causes us to just jump on every new thing and trumpet it from the rooftops?
I would have to say yes. Health and medical coverage is among the most popular that any newspaper, magazine, website can offer. People are understandably just, ravenous to hear, what can I do to keep myself healthy, to keep my children healthy, to help my elderly parents? And as a result, people are desperate. They seize on the flavor of the month, the magic pill, whatever cliche we want to apply here. Look at how tests for vitamin D just soared over the last few years. There were a couple of studies saying that, oh dear, people's vitamin D levels might be too low. Just go to enter the internet and type that in, and you can find more offers to have your vitamin D tested than you can shake a stick at. Well, when the cold light of day dawned just a couple of months ago, the Institute of Medicine assembled an expert panel to look at all of their research on the usefulness of having a blood test for vitamin D. And it concluded, again, based not on a single study, based not on a couple of studies, but on the totality, the entirety of the biomedical literature, that in fact almost everybody has enough vitamin D for bone health, that having a test really isn't necessary. And the cost of vitamin D supplements in this country is $425 million a year.
Hmm.
So, when we talk about, the cost of incorrect biomedical advice, of incorrect health advice, this is not chump change.
Well, and then you've got conflicting information as well. Go out in the sun because that helps your vitamin D level. Oh, by the way, don't go out in the sun because you could get skin cancer.
Right. Although crossing the street, I heard once, is enough to get your vitamin D for the day, and you probably will not get melanoma by crossing the street.
I guess that would depend on how wide the street was.
Fair enough.
And where you were in relationship to the equator. I don't know. Let's go to the phones before I get into even more trouble than usual. Bob in Franklin, you will be first. Bob, good morning.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that on the medications issue, I have a book that's called Worst Pills, Best Pills, A Consumer's Guide to Avoiding Drug-Induced Death and Illness. And it looks like it's put out by Public Citizens Health Research Group, and they also have a website.
Okay, Public Citizen, what was the name of the group?
Public Citizens Health Research Group.
Okay. Thanks, Bob, for that. Sharon Begley, have you ever heard of that?
I don't know the particular book, but Public Citizen is indeed a consumer watchdog. They led the charge for the recall of Vioxx. They have also been very active with some of the antipsychotics that turn out to be unsafe for a lot of patients. In general, books like that do point out the fact that, as you were alluding to earlier, John, in terms of individual differences, either, you know, a few or a lot or a worrisome number of patients who take a particular medication will have adverse effects. And the question for pharmaceutical companies and indeed for regulators, not to mention individual doctors, is how to balance the overall benefit that, you know, a huge population on average in general might get from something against the fact that individuals might be harmed by a drug. And when that calculus tips toward the harm side, then you have recalls of drugs, again, like Vioxx, and they're pulled from the market. But until that happens, you know, it's not a bad idea to ask your doctor about the side effects of drugs, to read the patient insert. Those are the pages and pages of itsy-bitsy print that we all need a magnifying glass to read. And, you know, be aware of the fact that these are powerful chemicals and they do have side effects.
Bob, thanks for that call. Let's go up to Sturgeon Bay next and hear from Donna. Donna, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. My question is slightly different, but I'm hoping you might be able to answer this. I want to see an endocrinologist. I have diabetes, and if I don't get a rash from any of the medications, I have other problems with them, and it just seems so different, and I want to see a good endocrinologist, and I would like to know, how do you find one?
How do you research a doctor, in other words?
Right. Well, and of course, it's all made the even more difficult by the fact that so many of us have health insurance that restricts the physicians whom we can see, or if you are old enough to be covered by Medicare, you have to find a physician who will take Medicare. My own rule of thumb is that you will generally be better off by consulting a physician who is affiliated with a major medical school, and the reason for that is that they tend to be up on the totality of the research, not just the latest flash in the pan. They have access to similarly well-informed, up on the research colleagues. They are in a network of people, so you are not necessarily depending on a single individual. If your case is particularly challenging or difficult, someone who is in a group practice like that, again, at a medical school, will be able to, you know, ask friends and colleagues, both formally and informally, you know, have they seen other patients who have rashes in response to the medication? Of course, if you are not located near one, that makes it all the more difficult. But if you are able to access a medical school, going on their websites, almost all of them have a little link that's called something like Find a Doctor, or you can scroll through the departments, in your case, as you say, endocrinology, and they often are quite happy to see new patients.
Thanks for the call, Donna. Well, let's go to Dennis in Racine next. Dennis, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Sharon. This thing about vitamin D, I was going to talk to you about prostate cancer, but it can get really involved. The information on prostate cancer has changed over the years, and it's quite hard to keep up with it. And that, but not, it's a bit complicated, but I'm interested now in the vitamin D question. I'm taking vitamin D. I was tested. It was low. I am a cancer patient, and I know the evidence isn't out there entirely, and I may be wasting money by buying this vitamin D, these pills. But if it turns out that the evidence shows that a vitamin D does help combat cancer, then I'm ahead. If otherwise, I'm out a little money. But if one is tested and the level of vitamin D is low, there's not much downside to start taking vitamin D, is there?
Let me take that in two parts. The idea that we should all be tested for vitamin D is the first thing to examine. And it turns out, again, according to the totality of the evidence, that 20 nanograms per milliliter is perfectly enough for bone health for vitamin D. Now, to your more important point, whether there is any harm to taking vitamin D, the sort of better safe than sorry, in that case, I would completely agree with you. We're not talking about taking a powerful synthetic compound. We're not talking about taking a drug. We're talking about something that is found in a great number of foods that, again, your body can make through exposure to sunlight. sunlight. So in that case, as an individual decision, you know, I think you are on perfectly safe ground. The question for the country as a whole is whether when either individual doctors or profit-making companies push the idea that we all need to be tested for vitamin D and do something to take supplements if the level is below 20 nanograms per milliliter. And I should say that a lot of people before this Institute of Medicine report were arguing that it should be higher than that. Then you run into, again, the $425 million a year cost to society. But that this just points out how sometimes the decision an individual makes will make perfect sense for that person, but multiply it by 300 million Americans, and you know, have something that society might want to be concerned about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. The vitamin D is supposed to have other health benefits other than strengthening your bones, isn't it?
Perhaps something to do with brain health, but those are on much shakier ground. Mostly the push to have testing for vitamin D and to take supplements has to do with, you know, osteoporosis and bone health.
Okay. Let's go next to Brittany in Kenosha. Brittany, good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I have a group of girlfriends who take a very natural approach to medicine and to health, and to the point where they don't agree with vaccinations to their children, to flu shots and birth control. So I guess what I would like to know is just your response to that, and maybe what you would encourage someone, you know, surrounded by that but not necessarily agreeing with it, what they could read about or look into to see if that is truth or if it's just going a little too far in the other direction.
Well, I'll get a lot of people mad at me by saying that I think that the science of vaccines is absolutely and perfectly sound. When I was saying to John at the top of the show that some things that have been established by decades of research, again, you know, smoking, drinking to excess, keeping your blood pressure under control, I should have included vaccines which have more than 100 years of safety testing, not for individual ones, but in general. The claim that vaccines, especially the measles, mumps, rubella one, increases the risk of autism has been shown to have been based on outright medical fraud. The research by a team in England in the 1990s. And as more and more parents of young children opt out of vaccination, opt out of childhood vaccination, we are seeing, you know, not to be too blunt about it, but dead children who were exposed to something that they were too young to be vaccinated against, but that they caught from older children whose parents chose not to have them vaccinated. The children contracted the illness and gave it to somebody whose immune system was very weak, and that two-year-old is now dead. So there are clear consequences both for the individual and for, you know, those around you when parents opt out of vaccinations.
Brittany, thanks. Thanks for that call. There does seem to be some sort of a backlash occurring against a lot of the traditional forms of medicine and people wanting to do things that are not, that don't involve taking prescription drugs. And we can go back to St. John's wort for depression and things like that. People wanting to be quote unquote more natural. But there's a downside to that, as you point out, with the vaccination issue. We need to be careful.
Well, even the so-called all-natural products, it's so interesting that people think that just because nature made it, there are no safety concerns. And, you know, we can just assume that the things are also effective at treating whatever ails you or at preventing whatever you don't want to get. But, you know, nature also made arsenic, and nature makes botulism. You know, when we were all children, our parents told us, don't pick leaves and eat them. Don't eat that stuff. You know, that could be poison. So it's just fascinating to me that people think that by buying something at a health food store, which, and maybe I should have said this explicitly at the beginning of this answer, have not been tested for safety and efficacy. The health food industry got a bill through Congress in the 1980s saying that they are exempt from all of the requirements that manufactured drugs have to meet. So the stuff that you buy in a health food store has not been proven to be safe and effective. So, you know, that really is a gamble.
All right, let's go back to the phones. As I expected, the phones have been just lit up all hour here, and we'll go next to Madison and hear from Colin. Colin, good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about research and doctors in the medical field. I'm a student in Madison, a college student, and I wanted to make a note that it shouldn't necessarily be on the doctors to find all of that research. I personally find that if people do their own research and read into some of the studies, that they can find quite a bit of information. As a student of science, though, I know that not a lot of studies are written in very plain English, so it seems that that maybe it's also on the scientists as well to put a little bit more into writing so that to be understood instead of writing to inform. Do you find that to be true?
I think Colin is absolutely right, and this is why I was saying earlier, when, you know, public health officials always turn it back to us, you know, ask your doctor or, you know, do your own research, that really is a tall order. John, you had asked earlier about whether there is any aggregation site that looks through all of this advice and sorts out what really has a strong empirical foundation and what's iffier. As I said, that's a business model waiting for somebody to exploit. It does not exist, to my knowledge, but there is an international group of experts who are brought together periodically to assess the evidence on, you know, whatever happens to be important at the moment. And it's called the Cochrane Collaboration, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. Easy to find their website. And they, when they are asked to look at, let's say, does taking antioxidant supplements reduce your risk of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, all things that they've looked at, they will, as I say, look not at a couple of studies. They will look at every single thing that has ever been published on that question, analyze whether the number of patients in a study was adequate to, you know, reach a conclusion, whether the way the study was conducted gives you reason to believe that it reached the correct conclusion. And they, having filtered through all this, will reach a bottom line, which, again, to Colin's point, is perfectly easy to understand. It's written in plain English, and it will say something like, antioxidants do not reduce your risk of Alzheimer's disease. So if somebody is interested in looking at blood pressure medications or you know, ways supposedly to prevent cancer, the Cochrane Collaboration studies are an excellent place to start.
Well, and I think one thing that people need to keep in mind, too, is that there's a big difference between anecdote and data. You know, I mean, one person saying, well, I ate this food and it cured condition X, isn't the same thing as someone doing a 20-year double-blind study of the effect of X food on Y condition.
Absolutely true. And yes, we are all suckers for the former. Again, reflecting the fact that it is so, so difficult for any, you know, just regular individual consumer or patient to wade through the biomedical research, when our neighbor, when our sister, when a parent, when a friend, when a clergyman, when a teacher, when that person says, you know what, I took ginkgo biloba and now I remember everything. It just, you know, just the way the human psyche is wired, we tend to believe that.
I like blueberries, I just don't remember why. Okay. We're talking with Sharon Begley, who is an award-winning science journalist, and she's the science editor of Newsweek, having a conversation about medical research. We get so much of it. We are bombarded with news about the world of medicine, and we all want to be healthier. We want to live longer. We want to be able to leap tall buildings at a single bound and be faster than a speeding locomotive and so forth. And so we're all hungry for information. And when you've got a vacuum like that, somebody's going to fill it. Well, there's a lot of news out there. There's a lot of research out there. And some of it, in fact, a lot of it is wrong, and you need to be careful. And that's kind of what we're talking about this hour with Sharon Begley. You can get in on the conversation. The phone lines, I believe there's one line open. If you get in quickly, you can make it at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:42. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller is in next here on the Ideas Network. And let me flip the page to find out what's going to be going on in his first hour. Did you know that this Friday is National Data Privacy Day? I did not know that. Larry Mueller's guest after 11 describes why data privacy is so important and how to protect yourself against ID theft. This hour we're talking about medicine, specifically how we parse all of the information that we get to try to find what's actually true about the benefits of this or that treatment, this or that medicine, this supplement or that supplement. My guest is Sharon Begley, science editor at Newsweek. We've got calls and we've got a couple of emails. I'd like to get these emails out first and then we'll go back to the phones. We have an email from Ron who says he wants to know, is a generic drug a true copy of the original? Great question.
It is chemically identical. So yes, I'll just stop there. The simple answer is yes.
It's the same thing, only cheaper. And then Larry in Rudolph writes, please sort out the websites that are objective and helpful to access for advice. Well, that might be a whole program in itself.
Yeah, that's a tough one. The NIH, National Institutes of Health, has a great website. It's full of stuff and therefore a little bit difficult to navigate. That's still a pretty good source, but I'm going to go back to my old favorite. If you want to sort out what the total evidentiary base for a particular piece of medical health advice is, my favorite has been the Cochrane Collaboration.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we'll start in La Crosse with Pete. Pete, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, John. Hi, Sharon. Sharon, when I read your article, I think I was supposed to be more surprised than I was, but I had read Gary Taub's What Good Calorie, Bad Calorie, and I think that people don't realize that there is so little connection in diet science and health science and diet practice and health practice in this country. And if you could take a few seconds, a minute, to speculate on why a country that bills itself as an advanced nation has such poor connection between science that's been peer-reviewed and everything else and how we actually practice health care.
Interesting question. Since I'm not a doctor, I don't have privy to how their minds work. But I think, you know, just taking a step back, yes, we fund biomedical research to the tune of, I think, the current budget for NIH is $26 billion. And that buys a lot, but it buys a lot that is also sometimes in conflict with itself. But why doctors don't follow the science is a fascinating question, and I'll be perhaps a little bit more provocative here. Even when as John, you were saying, a 20-year peer-reviewed study with, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people reaches a conclusion, there is a huge amount of pushback, resistance on the part of individual physicians. And the reason is, if I can psychologize here, doctors are hugely swayed, hugely influenced by their own individual experience with individual patients. So let me give you a couple of examples. It has been shown that arthroscopic surgery for osteoarthritis of the knee is no more effective than sham surgery. In other words, the study had some patients undergo the actual arthroscopic procedures, you know, scooping out the stuff in the knee joint, etc., see how they did. Equal number of patients just had fake incisions made. They thought they were undergoing the procedure. See how they did. The two groups of patients had identical outcomes. They had the same amount of relief from pain. So the thousands of dollars that we pay for arthroscopic surgery for knee arthritis is, shall we say, at least in question. But doctors will swear, surgeons will swear from now until the cows come home that that surgery absolutely did help their patient. And, you know, this sham surgery is just, you know, the fact that it was shown to be equally effective, there's something wrong with that study because they have patients in front of them who are walking again. Same with hormone replacement therapy. How many doctors swore up and down, even after that was shown to be not a way to prevent heart disease in older women, but in fact to increase breast cancer? How many doctors still insist, no, my patients do well on this? And again, I keep going back to psychology. I think the reason is that again, because of the way the human mind is wired, we pay much more attention to the examples that we see in front of us, to patients who are now walking, to women who are doing okay, much more attention than we pay to some dry data in a science paper in a journal.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of wishful thinking here as well, isn't there? I mean, we all want to be healthier. Maybe I'll go even a step further. Maybe we're a victim of the expectations that we have that science can solve all of our problems. So if I have some condition, maybe it's not treatable, but I don't believe that, because if I admit that, well, then I'm, you know, I have to, oh, okay, it's not treatable. And so I expect my doctor to be able to come up with some miracle that's going to save me. And the fact is that sometimes they can't.
And since we've been blaming the media for a lot of this, let me now blame baby boomers for a lot of it also, because we, and I put myself in that category, I don't know, do we think that we're going to live forever, or that we're going to live to be 100 with, you know, the minds and bodies of 45-year-olds and then, you know, get run over by a bus or something? But yes, that is a huge factor, as is the message that has been promulgated for many, many years, that we are all responsible for our own health, that you have to make smart choices. So we're desperate. You know, tell me what the smart choice is, and I'll do it.
Yeah, well, if the smart choice is not to have zingers for breakfast, then I'm already doomed. Let's see. Let's go to Scott in La Crosse next. Scott, good morning.
Hi there. Well, speaking of making the right choices, I think one of the things that hurts in this, there's a couple issues, actually. And one of them is the overkill that we get. And you hear them as a little news headline stories. That my favorite example is coffee, where Monday you'll hear, that second cup of coffee could be giving you a heart attack in 5 years. And then Tuesday you hear, that second cup of coffee could prevent you from getting Alzheimer's. And then Wednesday, that second cup of coffee is going to destroy your liver. And so finally, I think people just go, eh. And then the other issue, and I think there are organizations out there, and I'm not going to name names here, but I know there's at least one that has kind of become my own personal whipping boy, that comes out with these just over-the-top damnations of certain foods. Like one month they'll come out and say, eating Italian food is, that's heart attack on a plate. And then the next month they're out saying, Chinese food is going to kill you. And I think people just finally get to the point where they hear everything they like is good for them, is bad, good for them one day, bad for them the next day, or everything is going to do them in. And finally they just go, I give up. I'm just going to eat what I want.
I think that's an excellent point, and so I'll just name them. The Center for Science and the Public Interest does try to do things that are indeed in the public interest and warn us away from high-fat, high-sodium foods, et cetera. But, you know, as I think, John, you were saying earlier that even the connection between salt intake and blood pressure is really not settled science. So, you know, that's one thing. And even the connection between dietary fat and breast cancer or other forms of cancer is definitely up in the air. The connection between dietary fat, especially saturated fat, and cardiovascular disease, it is on a much stronger scientific footing. But yes, to your general point, people do either get whiplash. I think that's, you know, one chunk of the population. But unfortunately, another chunk of the population chases after Monday study. So they have that second cup of coffee because it's going to prevent Alzheimer's, and then they chase the next thing. So, you know, the conflicting health advice, again, what I keep calling the flavor of the moment, really has consequences for people's lives, and they're not good consequences.
Your article highlights the work of a specific physician, and I'll probably mispronounce his last name, Dr. John Ioannidis.
Ioannidis, very close.
Okay, Ioannidis. He's really made a kind of a crusade out of exposing some of the false claims and the bad research. Talk a little bit about his work.
Well, this is why I did the story. John Ioannidis had been at the NIH. He had been at Tufts, but mainly he was at a little college in Greece that, you know, no one in this country has ever heard of. And over the last few years, he had published a number of papers casting doubt in general on biomedical research and then taking particular aim at specific claims. So he has shown, for instance, that a number of the genes that have been associated with the risk of diseases, in fact, fact, really are not. He showed that, for instance, two studies concluded that vitamin E prevents cardiovascular disease. Well, in fact, it doesn't. That was overturned, but a lot of people haven't heard that it was overturned. We've talked about estrogen therapy for heart disease and even Alzheimer's. Again, that was overturned. And when I say the reason I did the story is this, Ioannidis had been sort of on the outside, sort of throwing rocks at the house. But in August, he was named to be the director of the Stanford Prevention Research Center, Stanford University's. And, you know, really, Stanford, when you ask what is, you know, the medical mainstream or the medical establishment, Stanford is definitely up there. So that is a recognition on the part of, again, the medical establishment, that the kinds of concerns that Ioannidis has been raising are something that we have to pay attention to, where we are the, you know, the scientific and biomedical mandarins. An interesting thing when I was reporting this story, you know, you as the journalist, you dutifully call around to see who thinks this guy is wrong, and I called, you know, scientist after scientist, biomedical researcher after researcher, and to a person, including those who had written criticisms of him in biomedical journals, they said, you know what, he's basically right. Too much of biomedical research is wrong. It's based on shoddy statistics, on a profit motive that skews the way research is done. We have to start listening to him.
Erica in Oconomowoc, you're next. Good morning.
Morning. I guess I'm concerned about the profit, too. I look at medicines like Celebrex and Vioxx, and they're basically the same medicine, and one is still on the market and one isn't. And it was Celebrex is the one that's on the market. And 9 years ago yesterday, my dad died of an allergic reaction from Celebrex, and his doctor didn't, like, prescribe him, like, take two Advil four times a day and see if your elbow pain gets any better. It just was like, oh, here's some Vioxx, try this, see if it, or here's some Celebrex, see if it helps. And, you know, when they say that this medicine may cause death, it's serious, it's real, and death is forever. I mean, he's never going to see my eight-year-old twins. I mean, there's just so many things. It seems like there's a real push to give the drugs, but then there isn't a push to, like, so many people probably have bad side effects that are never reported, that people just stop taking the medicine, and then it never gets back to the company or to the government to say, you know, this percentage of people are really having trouble with this medicine. And so,
Erica, thanks for the call. There are real world consequences to this. People actually die, this isn't just a medical statistic. This is a human being who never got to see his grandchildren.
It's just tragic. Now there is supposed to be a national reporting system for so-called adverse events. So when someone has, you know, either a rash from the diabetes medication, as an earlier caller described, or actually has a fatal allergic reaction to Celebrex, that is supposed to be reported by the physician to both state authorities and also to the FDA, to the national authority. The very sad thing about Celebrex and Vioxx, which belong to this category called COX-2 inhibitors for arthritis, is that they actually were never shown to be more effective at reducing the pain from arthritis, at improving your movement. Their big breakthrough was that they did not cause the gastrointestinal upset that the, you know, just the generic over-the-counter medications did that people were taking for their arthritis. But unfortunately, the pharmaceutical manufacturers pushed them as somehow this will cure your arthritis. But really, they were not more effective. They were just better for gastrointestinal upset, which is important. But, you know, I would venture, John, that 9 out of 10 people who were taking Vioxx, who are taking Celebrex, believe that it is more effective against their arthritis than, you know, plain old, you know, aspirin.
We've got less than 2 minutes. I wanted to wrap this up by, okay, we've kind of identified what the problem is, but what do we need to do? I mean, does the federal government need to require that all of these studies be published? Is there some new law that needs to be passed? Or do we just, as consumers, just need to do a better job of being in control of our own health care?
I'll say yes to the last. Don't believe a study that has, you know, 18, 25, 73 people, or that's been done for just a few months. Wait until there are thousands of patients and numerous studies. Yes, the government has to do a better job, and they are starting. Now, every clinical trial has to be registered with the government. So if a clinical trial is started, and maybe it shows that the medication isn't doing such a great job, and then you never hear about it again, that has to be recorded. And journals are now no longer publishing studies unless they include the studies that failed. So there is a little bit of hope on the horizon, but unfortunately, and I'm just going to parrot the advice that I criticized before, we all have to be wary consumers.
Caveat emptor.
Exactly.
So in closing, I just wanted to toss this out. Cruciform vegetables, good against cancer? What do you think?
I'm having broccoli for dinner tonight.
Excellent. That's broccoli's my my favorite vegetable. I love cabbage as long as you don't cook it. And prefer it raw. Well, thank you so much for being with us this hour. It's been a very enlightening hour, and I guess the big advice is we need to be in charge of our own research and working with our doctor to make sure that we get the best information out there. Thanks for making that point so clearly.
Thank you, John.
Sharon Begley is science editor at Newsweek. She's an award-winning science writer. You can find her work at www.newsweek.com, www.newsweek.com. The title of the article, if you wanted to read it, is Almost Everything You Hear About Medicine Is Wrong. This program was produced for me by Rhonda Fanning, who also handled on-air production. And Kathleen will be back next week on this program. I'm just the fill-in for today. Veronica Rickard is on tomorrow. And coming up after the news, we'll hear from Larry Mueller. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today, reminding you that you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.